Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location. Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You heard from Miss West, who said he was crying scared. I talked about R a moment ago. He was crying scared. And I suspect what you're going to hear from the other side is, well, we didn't get good information. Remember that from Dr. Klinger? Well, we didn't get good information. We didn't know that he was crying and scared. Somebody should have told Dr. Parker that he was crying and scared. When we go out onto the road and there's a stop sign on the corner of the street, tuck it behind a little corner or right there for us to see either way. It's our job as we're driving down the road to see the stop sign. It's our job to look out for the stop sign. It's our job to find the rules of the road and the signs of the road so that we can then govern our behavior. It was Dr. Parker's job to investigate. The manual that governed their relationships amongst each other told her that you must first assume it is credible unless analysis suggests differently. Cause the student making the threat, if known and on campus, to be immediately removed pending further investigation. What does that mean? That means you can't stick your head in the sand. You cannot stick your head in the sand and then come into court and say, I didn't have the information, when it was your job to find it, when it was your job to look for it and to do the investigation and to talk to that little boy who saw the gun and to talk to those two little girls who talked about the gun and to talk to all of these people. If it's your job to investigate, which their handbook tells them it was, you can't come into court and say, I'm going to close my ears, close my eyes, put my head on my desk, and then use that as a defense to my case. The law says you know it because it was there to be known, because the stop sign was on the corner of the street and it should have been seen. It's no excuse to walk into court on a traffic ticket and say, well, judge, I didn't see the stop sign. The stop sign was there. The stop sign was there, feet, yards from her. And then, in my view, you turn up the dial. Because at this point in the afternoon, there is a accumulation of information. We saw a gun. It was supposed to be in a backpack. We don't know where it is. It might be in his pocket. It was shown to a boy at recess with bullets.
We still don't know where it is. He's crying, won't go to class. And another request, can we search the person? And I suspect they'll come up here and they'll say, well, Mr. Rawls told you that he didn't think it was credible. My response to that is let's look at actions, because our actions speak louder than our words. Did we hear any other evidence of Mr. Rawls coming and asking to search just kids at random when he didn't think there was a threat? We talked, and all of the evidence is that searching, and even Dr. Klinger told us, searching a child is something that you do delicately. You only do if it's necessary. That's what they're taught. And he came to her directly and said, have we searched the boy? Again. And he wasn't the only one in that moment. Because in that moment, when she heard, West heard, that they had not searched the person, Mr. Sims goes and stands outside the door of Mr. Rawls and Dr. Parker and says, are we searching the person? That's three times somebody is asking her to do this. Three times. Countless times where we're talking about the boy throughout the day and the gun and where it is, but three times to search the boy. That should be flashing at you to act. And the response? Let's hold off. Let's hold off. It's 1:40 in the afternoon. Mom's going to be here at 2:30 p.m. to pick him up. Let's hold off. I told you that I would talk more about promises, right? When Mr. Rawls walks down the hall, being told directly, let's hold off and wait for mom to come and then we'll take the action. What does that tell us, like the rain that we did not see? It tells us that she still thinks there's a gun. If she doesn't think there's a gun, what are you holding off for? If you don't think there's a gun, you don't say, we'll wait for mom to come and we'll do the search. You say, there's no gun. Let me go back to my testing. It's that creeping thought, that knowledge that there is still a gun on campus that leads to somebody saying, we probably still need to do something, but let's hold off. Every minute matters. Every minute matters. And they'll say, no, that's not what she thought. That's not what she knew, right? We had a time with Dr. Klinger, weapon, firearm, we'll talk about that in a second. The very first witness in this case, and it's sometimes hard to forget because it's a week ago, the very first witness in this case interviewed Dr. Parker within days, in January of 2023, of this incident. And Dr. Parker herself said the students reported a gun in a backpack. Don't take my word for it. Take hers. At 12:20. And that at 1:40, there were still concerns of a weapon on campus. Her words to the school system as part of the investigation. Not my words. That means for an hour and 20 minutes. Hour and 20 minutes. And we still got another 20 before Ms. Werner shot. There is a gun on campus. And they come up here with Dr. Klinger and say, well, she needs more information. What more do you need? You knew who. You knew what. You knew when. You knew where he was all day. You knew when he was in the classroom. You knew when he was on the playground. You knew when he was back in the classroom. What more do you need to act when a gun changes everything? And this is no time to play name games. This is no time for, well, maybe the child said bullets. Is bullets really a gun? Ladies and gentlemen, if you have an elementary school, 6-year-olds, if we looked at the classroom walls, we're still teaching them how to use punctuation correctly and what words to use and how to capitalize letters. And you're going to wait until a boy says, no, it was a gun, it was a real gun, it was black, it had bullets in the gun? No, ma'am. Gun, bullet, weapon, firearm, we don't need to talk about what all they mean. Each of them required a response. Each of them. But what we know for certain is that it was a gun from her herself. And they're going to come up here and tell you hindsight 2020. Remember that? Hindsight 2020. It's easy to see now that there was a shooting, that we look backwards, and now that we know there was a shooting. It's easy to know that looking at our rearview mirror. You don't need to look in the rearview mirror. There were road signs in front of Dr. Parker for an hour and a half, screaming at her, flashing at her, telling her exactly what was going to happen if she did not act. You do not need to look in the rearview mirror to know what's coming ahead. And the only reason it's in her rearview mirror is that she blew past the signs. She blew past the signs. Do we need every letter to know what it means? Do we need every letter? They're going to tell you this wasn't foreseeable. Remember that discussion? Wasn't foreseeable that this would happen. And that's why we talked about this question of foreseeability. And I'll show you an instruction on this. This is instruction 17. The defendant is not required to have anticipated or foreseen the precise injury, but it is sufficient that a reasonably prudent person would have anticipated or foreseen that some injury or damages might probably result from the negligent act. What does that mean? What that means is, and what they're going to try and argue to you is, who could have seen that a 6-year-old would pull out a gun from his pocket, point it at a teacher, and shoot? That's not the question. The question is for every moment, every minute, every second that a gun is in the possession of a 6-year-old who, I agree, has totally unpredictable behavior. If anybody has dealt with 6-year-olds, it's totally unpredictable. All the more reason to find the gun. All the more reason. That gun could have been popping up and down in his jacket and gone off. Handed it to a friend and gone off. Showed it to a friend and a book hit it and gone off. Dropped on the floor and gone off. You do not have to foresee the precise injury that was caused. Only that some injury or damages might probably result. We can go to the... And for 2.5 hours, this thing was beeping on her radar. Beeping. I use this as a metaphor to talk about what we just talked about. Because the focus here is a gun in a 6-year-old's hand. But I want you to think for a moment. Imagine there was a gun sitting right here on the playground at an elementary school, and a student comes up and says, there's a gun on the playground. Isn't the danger apparent just with a gun near the proximity of any of these agreeably unpredictable children. Isn't that the danger? Because the gun is what changes everything. And you may hear, well, we don't know if it was a real gun. We don't know. I think we heard from Dr. Klinger. Maybe it's kids talk about squirt guns all the time. You really going to take that chance? Really going to take that chance? I have friends that like to play roulette. When they go up to the roulette table and they throw that ball and they put their chips on whatever color they want, you know what they've already decided? Win, lose, or draw, I'm indifferent. That money's gone. If I win, great, I'll have a great night. If I lose, I've already accepted the fact that I've lost. They are indifferent to the chips on the table. They are indifferent to the odds that are before them. And if you're willing to gamble on a real gun or a squirt gun at an elementary school, you are indifferent to what happens next. You're going to hear from the other side, and I'll point this out to you in an instruction. This question of gross negligence. It's instruction 13. The degree of negligence which shows indifference to others that constitutes an utter disregard of caution amounting to a complete neglect of safety of another person. Indifference. And the other thing that you'll find in your instructions, and I'll point this out to you to say, a gun changes everything. I've said it many times. I'll say it again. That first time, that first moment, not acting is indifference. Every minute is indifference. But even if it was just me trying to hit the apple instead of me trying to throw the ball at Jeffrey, even if it was not indifferent the first time, you follow? Even if the first time wasn't indifferent, what the law says is if I keep trying to throw the ball and hit Mr. Williamson, and every act of that attempt is its own negligence, those add up. And you start to wonder, what are you thinking? Why do you keep trying to throw the ball and you're not getting the outcome that you're trying to achieve? And so each minute, I said every minute matters, because each minute in which there's nothing done, in which the actions that she's supposed to take are not taken, in which she's not ensuring the safety of the people on that campus, each minute adds up. It adds up, even if each one of them on their own is an indifference. Go to the PowerPoint. Care is a verb. Care is a verb. What do I mean? It means that when you hear from the other side that she did something, she cared enough to acknowledge that there would be a search. She cared enough to say, well, we'll have a plan to search the boy when the mom gets here. That those acts of caring, those feelings of caring, are enough. The response is, care in the law is not a feeling. Care in the law is a verb. It's an action. And the question is, what actions did she take in an effort to meet her obligation? Part two, blame game. We'll go quick. This is the defense. Mistakes were made, but none by me. All right, let's point the finger at all of these other people and say that they did the wrong thing. And I told you guys in voir dire, if many of you might remember, I said, look, at the end of this case, this case isn't about the parents. This case isn't about other people. The question's just going to be whether she was grossly negligent or not. And that doesn't deter them. They're pointing the finger at everyone that they can point the finger at to try and deflect responsibility and play the name game. And the issue with that is that each of those people that they're trying to point the finger at had a piece of the puzzle on January 6th. They all had an element of it, whether it was the backpack or whether it was the bullets or whether it was the shoot or whether it was the search. Each had a piece of the puzzle. But you know who had the entire puzzle? Dr. Parker. Dr. Parker. And what they're doing is that they're telling you that, well, these individuals should have investigated. Ms. Kovac should have investigated. Mrs. Werner should have pulled the kid out of class. Ms. West should have done something else at the parking lot. What the policies tell us in their agreements with each other in terms of how they're going to operate at the school is that those were all her job. And so what they're saying is Dr. Parker dropped the ball and they want somebody else to pick it up for her and do it. That's not right. And every time they come up here and say that XYZ person should have done something different, that Ms. Kovac or maybe Mr. Rawl should have searched, just tilt that rearview mirror and look at it yourself. Because every finger that's pointed at somebody else by the other side of this case should really be a finger pointed at themselves in the mirror. What their job was, these staff members, was to be watchmen and to sound the alarm, and it was the job of administration within each of these policies to answer the call and to come and to do something about it. And each of them sounded the alarm, and they waited on the cavalry, and no one came. I told you I'd tell you about that moment where he said, hold on. Remember the moment Mr. Rawl says to Abby, hang tight. Hang tight, we're coming. Every minute matters. And what Mrs. Werner should have seen coming through that door was the help that was promised to her. That we're coming. The cavalry is on the way. The first time Mrs. Werner saw a police officer on January 6th, 2023, should have been when they walked through that door, not when she was laying on her back in the administrator's office. Whew. So, Jed, pause. Pause. I don't want to rush through this. I'm going to try and be efficient, but I don't want to rush through this because it's so important. Costs and consequences. This is the part that we talked about in voir dire, and I said, how do we come to this number? How do we come to an amount of money? How is that done? And to some of you, I said, we'll go through it. I'll give you tools or I'll give you ideas, and we'll talk about the law, and we'll get you there. We'll make sure you understand what your job is and how to do it. And so with your permission, I'll start with a statement that I hope, I suspect, everyone agrees to, everyone in this courtroom, everyone in this courtroom. There is no material item, possession, object on this earth that is worth more than a human life. Not a single one. You're not supposed to watch the news, according to the judge. You can still watch the news. And last night I was sitting and I was watching the news and I saw the news of a plane that crashed outside of Louisville, Kentucky. A UPS plane. And you know the first question that the newscaster asked how many lives were lost? He didn't ask, well, how much the plane cost? Or was it holding freight? Or what was the freight? Or what was in the plane? The first question that each of us thinks, whether it's in our gut, in our head, or out our mouth, is how many lives were lost? And that's because there isn't a single thing on this planet that is worth more than a human life. So we start there. And then the question is, how do we count the value of a human life? Well, over time, we've come up with phrases that we use every day. We use phrases like, time is money. Heard that one? Time is money. We hear phrases that started in the 1600s and the 1700s that say, can I have a penny for your thoughts? Or, is it worth my time? All of these questions tell us that we understand that there is a value, a dollar sign, as weird as it seems to think about it, that we equate to our human experience, that we count in minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years. And you heard it in this courtroom. We had experts take the stand, and they were asked, how much are you being paid for your time? Remember that? $500 an hour to be here. Now, Dr. Klinger took the stand for about 2.5 hours, more than $1,000, sitting in this courtroom, talking about life experiences that she lived. And nobody blinked an eye. We understand, whether we ever think about it or not, that there is an equation, that we can equate human life and our experiences to dollars and cents. And it's my job to try and talk to you about that, and it's ultimately your job to decide how much it's worth. So, the jury instructions will tell you what I call what buckets or elements of damages to think about. And when I say that, I mean these four things right here. And we'll take them in order. And I'll tell you that I'm going to merge some of them. So we're first going to talk about bodily injuries, disfigurement, and deformity. The law says that if she is entitled to recover, that is, if Ms. Warner has proven her case, that she's entitled to recover money for each of these elements. So, why did we put on the evidence? Why did we, if we can go back, put on the evidence of these three doctors and other doctors that came before you? Is to show you the injuries. To show you the injuries so that you could understand, based on the jury instruction, how bad, how severe, and duration, which is what the jury instruction says. How long will this be? And this is what we talked about. That a bullet pierced through her hand, into her rib, through her lung, and that it pooled. Remember that from Dr. Munn? That it pooled and it collapsed her lung, but that cavity is still in her body. And because that cavity is there and that bruising comes through, we talked about scar tissue. Like you pull a muscle and it never goes back to the way it's supposed to be. And it stays that way and it affects the way that they can breathe. And it pierced through her hand. And we had pictures of the fragments that were through the wrist. And we talked about the issues with the thumb and the index finger and the middle finger. And you heard Dr. Anderson tell you that this is the type of injury we see in war. That it's devastating. And that even though the bullet made its way through the hand and into her body, it still rests there today. And it still rests there today because it is 2 centimeters. 2 centimeters from her aorta. She was 2 centimeters from death. And that's never going to change. It's never going to change. It's there forever, and we talked about the surgeries that were done. And even to this day, she sits here with a piece of metal on her finger. Not because she did anything wrong, but because this bone still will not heal. And I will tell you, whether that bone heals or does not heal, we know for certain her wounds, all of them, will never go away. Don't we know that? Don't we know that even every moment she goes into the doctor's office and has concerns about what her medical condition might be, and she has to tell them, I've got a piece of metal 2 centimeters from my aorta, I can't have that test. I can't do that thing that I might need. And so when we talk about bodily injuries and their severity and their duration, what we're talking about is how bad is it in the way that it affects somebody's life every day. And if you can't open a chip bag, and somebody might say on the other side, it's just a hand. It's just a hand. Is it? Is it when you return home from surgery and the hospital and you're with your mother, and we're talking about disfigurement and deformity, and you can't move your hand, and you can't bathe yourself at 25 years old, you can't use the restroom by yourself? Are we just talking about a hand? Or are we talking about what it is to have dignity and be a human being? The element of instruction talks about mental anguish. It talks about physical pain and mental anguish. But I'll tell you right now, physical pain, she felt more than anyone could ever imagine. I promise you that. And we showed you videos to try and tell you and show you exactly what it was like. But even when the pain goes away, or goes down, this doesn't. This keeps going. And we heard from Dr. Watson, and we spent time talking about re-experiencing. Do you remember that? And I had a roadmap stop with Dr. Watson that said, brain and body. Remember that? Brain and body. Why did we talk about brain and body? Because you don't injure part of a human being. You don't just injure a hand or an arm. You injure all of them. You change all of them. And what we heard about and what we talked about is a young woman at 25 years old, who had chosen her way of life, who had decided who she wanted to be, where she wanted to go, and the purpose that she would achieve. You heard from her sister that said she had a purpose. She knew what she wanted, and she was chasing it at 25 years old. And some may say, do you want to be a teacher? Really? That's what she wanted. Maybe it's because her mother did it. Maybe it's because she wanted it for herself. But that was her choice. And they'll talk to you about cosmetology school, like she had considered this beforehand. Really? Really? She chose to be a teacher, knowing full well from the experiences of her mother exactly what it meant. That it meant sitting with a printer next to you while you sat next to your sister and she watched movies. That it meant late nights. That it meant early mornings. That it meant difficult times with your students. That it meant being around them and shaping the future of our country. And I'm not saying that to you to tell you that being the teacher is the most valuable thing in the world. What I'm telling you is that it was her choice. It was her choice, and her choice to be what she wanted to be is changed and taken from her. What do we value that at? What do you value it at when you decide that this is who you're going to be in life? And through no fault of your own, against your will, and without your consent, that's taken from you. That dimming of a light of a young woman who used to pop at you with color. That numbing of life's experiences. Numbing of it. What is that? That's not every couple months. I told you I would repeat this. Every minute matters. Every minute matters. When you change a human being, when you change who they are, and you rob them from the control to decide who they will be in the future, you've changed them forever. You've transformed that person. And the Abigail Zwirner that sits here in front of us today, on this day, November 5th, 2025, is not the same Abigail Zwirner that walked into the classroom on January 6th, 2023. Does anybody have a doubt of that? It's not the same person. I'm not saying it's no one anymore. I'm not saying she's any less of who she was. What I'm telling you is that she's been changed and she didn't want to be changed. And what damages do you arrive at? What number do you arrive at for somebody who didn't want this and it's been inserted into her life like a bullet fragment against her spine? Every minute matters. I showed you the video of her laying. You know the video I'm talking about, right? Outside the office. I don't need to show you again, right? I don't need to show you again as she laid in the office and the color that her sister talked about in her face and the light that was in her life you could see was sucked out of her in that moment. And I asked her to step out of this room when we showed that video. I asked her to step out of the room because she doesn't need to see the video to know what that was like. That was her life. She lived it. And just like it might be burned in your memories, do you think it's not burned in hers? And when you think about moments of compensation, what is fair? The question that I ask you to determine is if in that moment, and if in that moment someone came to Ms. Zwirner and said, Abby, this is what you're about to experience. This is what we're going to put you through. There's going to be a boy's face you'll never forget. It's going to come to you when you don't want it to. And you're going to be walking down a hall and you're going to be thinking you're on your way to heaven. And then for a moment, you're going to think you're not going there. Until you're shocked back to life with the pain and pressure of a colleague trying to save your life. If I stopped this case right there, if we stopped it in that moment in time, at 1:59 in the afternoon on January 6th, do you think that Abigail Zwirner would trade any amount of money and say, yeah, I'll go ahead and experience that? That moment that I thought I was not going to heaven, that my faith had failed me, I'll trade that for $10 million? Do you think she would trade it? She wouldn't. She wouldn't for a moment, but your job is the difficult one, which is to say how much would be fair and full if she had to take a trade. If a trade was forced upon her, what would be the fair amount of money? Because that's what's happened. It was forced upon her, and you have to decide how much would be close. And not just for that moment, but for the next, and the next, and the next, and the moments where she wakes up in the middle of the night, thinking of that exact moment, reliving it again, like it's playing on the screen in front of you and she doesn't need to see it. What is that worth? There are some holes. I told Miss Toscano not to get too close to me, but it reminded me of something. We've all had that moment where you're getting a cold. You can feel it coming on, right? You can feel the tickle in your throat. And it's coming to you and you're thinking, tomorrow, probably not gonna feel too good. My nose is gonna start to run. Next day, I may have a cough. I'm gonna stay away from people. Next day, I'm gonna feel worse. My head's gonna hurt. But what we have when we have those colds is that we know that one day will come, whether it's tomorrow, the next, or next week, that we're going to throw our legs off of our bed. We're going to sit at the end of it. And you're going to go, it's gone. I don't have it anymore. It's not with me. She will never have that moment. As much as she wishes to escape in her dreams and escape in real life, every time she throws her legs off the bed, that will be with her forever. And every time she sees somebody reach their hands in their pockets, which I've tried to be conscious of, will be picking a scab at a wound that will never heal. It is for all these reasons, and for all of these moments, that when you sat here a week ago, I asked you that we would be asking you for a verdict for $40 million, and if the evidence supported it, could you return the verdict? It is because she will never be the same, and somebody might say, they might say, that's a lot of money. It is a lot of money. I agree. But do you think for a moment she would trade it for what she's endured? If we could tell Abby to walk out that door right now, and her sister could look in her eyes and talk to her again, do you think she would trade? This is the final thing I'm going to talk to you about. When you get back into that deliberation room, I want you to remember our conversation in jury selection, and I asked you about rendering a verdict based upon sympathy or not. Remember that conversation. And I said to you, it's not supposed to be based on sympathy for her, but it's also not supposed to be based on sympathy from Dr. Parker. Because when you go through this calculation and you decide what all of these harms and these losses and what's been taken from her is worth, it's not up to you to decide where the money comes from. It's up to you to decide what it's worth. What it's worth. And if you get back into that deliberation room and there's a conversation and somebody says, well, what effect will that have on Dr. Parker? Or how will she ever be able to pay it? And if for those reasons you reduced your verdict, the number might be correct. Whatever number it is that you decide in that moment might be correct. But it would be the right verdict for the wrong reasons. Because the only reason that you can reduce the amount of what it's worth to her is if you decide it's not worth as much as what we're asking. And that's a critical point, because at the end of the day, what we want is a right verdict, but we want it for the right reasons. Because if it's full, it's full justice. Whatever full means to you, whatever you decide full is, that is full justice. in any centimeter or sip less than full justice is injustice. And injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so when you decide this case, when you analyze the facts, when you consider all the evidence, and you decide what's full and what's fair, I'm asking you, and I trust you, to render the right verdict for the right reasons. Thank you so much for your attention.
All right, thank you, Mr. Benyazin. All right, I think based on the timing, it's probably appropriate to take a lunch break now because you wanted a break to set up anyways,
yeah,
correct?
I can take a short break and go ahead now, or I can wait till
I think because it's 1 o'clock, we'll go ahead and take our lunch break now. We'll keep it to 45 minutes, so no one has to go anywhere. We will come back at 1:45 for the defense's closing and then my final instructions to you. Please do not discuss the case yet. It is not time for you to do so. All right? All right, thank you. Let me take the jury out for lunch.
Please stand for the jury.
You can set up whatever you need, all right? All right, thank you. Prepared with your closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you may bring in the jury.
Your Honor, confirming when you excused the jury, you didn't mention rebuttal. Just wanted to make sure there's still a rebuttal.
Yeah.
Just a check.
Continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.